Hello, my name's Joshua McClelland and you're listening to Josh Talks. Again, thank you for the continued support. We'll talk about last week's episode. Last week's episode, we had a man called Alan Philpott. Alan Philpott is a mixed martial artist from Ballymena. He talks about his journey with Rodney Moore. He talks about competing all over the world, moving to Australia, competing, rehabbing an injury. The episode was a lot of fun to record. This week on the podcast, we recorded with Sean Colbert. It was a great episode. It's so insightful. He talks about mindset. He talks about so many different things. I'll give you a quick background on Sean's life. Sean is a strength and conditioning coach. He currently lives in Thailand. He works with some real high-level fighters. The most famous example is probably Peter Yan. We talk about him playing rugby for the Australian Defence Force Army. We talk about him completing basic sniper training in 2008. We talk about him serving in the army. We talk about lessons that he's learned. We talk about so many things. Make sure you keep listening because you don't want to miss it. Welcome to Josh Talks. Hello, Sean. How are you?
Good, Josh. Thanks for having me on, mate.
That's not a problem. Well, how's the weather over there in Thailand?
A little bit overcast at the moment, but I mean, it's warm. Even if it is raining, it's still warm, so no complaints, really.
Yeah, I remember, like, I lived in Kenya for, like, 3 months, and back home where I live, like, Northern Ireland, it's normally always very, very cold, and I went, like, during, like, Kenya's sort of winter. And I was still running about in shorts and a tank top, like, and they're all looking at me, they're all wearing big massive coats, hood up, everything, and I just run about in a pair of shorts.
Yeah, who's this crazy little white kid?
Yeah, so it's all been going well. Where can people find you on social media?
Yeah, so I'm at coach_Kobes, K-O-B-E-S, is my Instagram, performance functional training. So for people that don't know, I'm the head strength and conditioning coach at Tiger Muay Thai based out of Phuket, Thailand. And people that have been listening probably listened to the John Hutchinson episode, the striking coach who works with a lot of the UFC fighters. So I work in conjunction with Johnny at Tiger and run the strength and conditioning for a lot of the fighters and the fitness department at Tiger.
What's that like, working in Thailand as a strength and conditioning coach?
Fucking awesome, man. I'm not gonna lie, it's a dream job, bro. I got out of the army in 2012. I served with the Australian Army for 6 years, did 3 deployments, and when I first discharged from the army and went out into the civilian space, I did my PT course, and as most PTs will attest, everyone wants to work with athletes, professional athletes in particular, so that was always the goal. So you know, I started working with athletes in rugby, you know, individual representatives in hockey, and state national representatives in multiple sports. Primarily with rugby teams, though, was where I was focusing most of my strength and conditioning. And then, you know, just wasn't getting the opportunities that I wanted in a small town, a small state of Australia, Tasmania. So I lived there for 5 years, and wasn't getting the opportunities that I wanted. So I ended up relocating to Thailand.
I suppose it's very difficult as well. You know, like, obviously there's a lot of big rugby teams in Australia, but it's one of those ones when it's at that sort of professional level, they already have someone there and you're almost all just like waiting for that opportunity.
Yeah. So I'm in the private sector, so it's a lot harder to get into those big professional teams. Like the Institute of Sport and professional rugby teams and netball teams and all that type of stuff. So yeah, it's a lot more difficult in the private sector.
What was it like? Obviously, we're skipping way ahead in your story, but just as it's conversation. So you're working in Thailand and you're working with some really talented athletes, world-class athletes. And I think the most notable one, which I was talking to John about, is Peter Yan or Petter Yan.
Yep. Yeah, what was the question, sorry?
What was it like working with him?
Awesome, man. He's the ultimate professional. I mean, most of the fighters are, you know, the ultimate professionals, but he's just on another level, man. You know, he's always first in the gym, last to leave, typically the hardest worker in the room. So yeah, it's crazy, man. Like I've spoken about this numerous times on other podcasts that I've been interviewed for my own podcast. My job as a strength and conditioning coach, yes, it is to build his strength, speed, power, endurance, energy systems, etc. But really, man, like, you know, he's working with John Boy on his striking. He's working with the Hickman brothers for George for his MMA. He's working with Frank on his wrestling. He's working with Alex for his BJJ. He's working with Lai for his Muay Thai. You know, so all of these other coaches are hammering him and they're like pushing him to get the most out of every session. And then he gets to me and he's walking into the gym with his, you know, dragging his heels and his head's down. And I go through some balance-based work, some assessments, and I can see that his body's under stress. And, you know, if I go and hammer him into the ground, then I'm just adding more stress on top of stress. And, you know, that's then potentially taking away from some of his other training sessions. So yes, my job is to push him and get the most out of him, but it is also to pull him back and make sure that he's not doing too much that, you know, he starts going into his other training sessions and he's tired, he's fatigued, he's practicing shitty technique, which is then going to carry over to the cage. You know, his immune system's compromised, which then increases, you know, the potential for injury and sickness and illness and things like that. And I did listen to your conversation with Johnny, and it was funny because when he was talking about, you know, 3 weeks out from the fight, you know, Peter normally gets something happen. He's typically dealing with things, blah, blah, blah. And like, that's what I see from my side is, you know, all these other coaches don't understand the importance of rest and recovery. Yes, it is important to get the most out of that client and fucking push them to elicit the response that you want, but you also need to be able to manage the energy, manage the stress, manage your recovery and workload so that they don't start picking up injuries and, you know, dragging their heels and being sick and injured going into those last couple of weeks leading into a fight.
I suppose is there's a lot of probably, I can imagine, a lot of anxiety when you're dealing with fighters, especially as, you know, a coach, like you mentioned, like the Hickman brothers doing the MMA and wrestling, John doing the boxing. And like from that sort of perspective, you want to make sure your athlete is prepared as possible and you've covered all bases. But there definitely has to be room for, you know, sort of recovery as well. And what are you doing different for recovery? Is it just sort of working on like flexibility and sort of like mobility and just sort of that sort of stuff? Or what are you doing?
Yeah, it depends, man. So, you know, guys like Peter Yan, that don't live in Thailand all year round, you know, I might only get them, or, you know, all of the coaches, we only get them for, you know, 4, 6, 8, 10 weeks of a fight camp. We don't get them the rest of the year. And something I came from, I don't actually have like a combat sports background. I've been dabbling in MMA, BJJ, boxing with Johnny and Sam, the other boxing coach who recently left Tiger. I've been dabbling with them over the last couple of years. I'm obviously at a combat-based camp, so I've got an opportunity to get into those classes and drill and train. And, you know, it's important for me to understand what they need, how they're moving, you know, compensatory patterns, likely dysfunctional areas and muscular imbalances caused by overuse injuries and things like that. So it's important for me to get in and do that stuff. But I mean, at the end of the day, like I'm a strength and conditioning coach, which means that I can work with any athlete, doesn't matter what the sport is, to elicit the responses that we want. But then it's just about applying the right tools at the appropriate time to get that response without overdoing it. So what I'm taking from my team sports background, I grew up playing rugby, you know, and multiple other team sports when I was a younger guy coming up through the ranks. But more recently, I, you know, been playing rugby for like 20 years at some relatively high levels. And the biggest thing that I've taken away from that is like a periodized training plan where, you know, we have a preseason, or sorry, we have an off season, and then we have a preseason, and we have the in season, and then we want to be peaking at the right time. You know, we don't want to be peaking halfway through the season and then burning ourselves out and then, you know, limping home into the finals. We want to go through an undulating training program so that we can, you know, build our aerobic capacity and our aerobic base in the off season. We can build our strength. We can put on some muscle. We can start addressing muscular imbalances and dysfunctions overuse injuries and things like that. Then we go into a strength phase. Then we go into a power and a speed phase. Then we start going into our anaerobic based work, you know, and then once we get in season, then it's about managing those different modalities, including recovery, so that, you know, we can still get the guys working. You know, it's not about adding more when we get in season. It's more about maintaining what we've built in the off season, and then managing workload, stress management, and recovery, so that, you know, we can roll into the weekend and be at our best and peaking at the right time. So bit of a ramble there, but the point that I'm getting at is I've actually recently started, about 8 months ago, I started a periodized all year round training plan for the sponsored fighters that are based out of Tiger, where I'm training them a couple times a week. And, you know, they're not in camp, because for the most part, most fighters, man, like, they're either on the wagon or they're off the wagon. And what I mean by that is, when they're on the wagon, they're all in. They don't have a fight coming up yet. They're training three times a day. They're eating fucking 1800 calories, and, you know, they're smashing themselves. They're not allowing their body to rest, recover. They're not allowing themselves that psychological flexibility of being able to have a couple of beers with the boys on the weekend, or eat ice cream every now and again, or whatever. You know, they're all in all the time. So once it comes to, once they sign a contract, they're 8 weeks out from a fight, you know, they're still already training three times a day. They haven't built their strength, speed, power, etc. They've just been going through all of their martial arts, their combat based work. You know, they haven't built the foundation outside of that, so that once they sign that contract, now they've got nowhere to go. They've already used all of their tools. So my philosophy is, get these fighters training all year round, where I'm undulating their training. We're focusing on different aspects of strength and conditioning. Again, we might go through a reverse diet period where I'm bumping their calories up. Man, I've got a girl who's fighting for Combat Americas. I think, what day is it? Friday 30th, we're recording this. So she's fighting tonight over in Miami, Florida. And, you know, she's been at Tiger for a couple of years, and the last 6 to 8 months that I've been working with her is the most progression that I've seen her make in the last 4 years, because she was that athlete that was training three times a day. She was, you know, eating really clean all the time, and she was just grinding, trying to make it. And then once I got hold of her, started working with her management team, you know, we work on the other aspects. We're focusing on mobility, stability, strength, speed, power, energy system conditioning, stress management, recovery mechanisms, et cetera, et cetera. I'm getting her to take her, you know, her blood pressure every morning. I'm getting her to take her waking heart rate. I'm getting her to take her heart rate variability. All these metrics then give me data, and give her data more specifically, that's going to allow her to then tweak and adjust her training session. And if her heart rate variability is low, that means her body's under stress. That means, hey, maybe don't go into a fucking hard wrestling session this afternoon. Maybe just do the drilling and don't go into the five hard rounds. You might do the drilling and then do two hard rounds. Okay, boom, session's done. You know, because you've got that biofeedback, you've got that data that then determines what you should be doing with your training. You know, so I've implemented that stuff with her. And as I said, you know, she signed a contract about 10 weeks ago, and we got her up to eating 2,500 calories, and she was only training once or twice a day, right? So we had plenty of room to move, man. She was fighting at 53.5. She was walking around about 60 kilos. I'm like, cool. If we can drop, you know, 3 to 4 kilos over the next 8 weeks, and we can get you 4 kilos above your fight weight 2 weeks out from your fight, you're fucking good to go. You know, now we can start adding some more hard training sessions in. We've built the foundation of strength and conditioning outside of fight camp, so that now, once you've signed that contract, let's start sharpening your skills in your Muay Thai, in your wrestling, in your BJJ, in your striking, all of these other attributes that, I mean, she's a fighter, right? So she needs to practice all of those skills and drills to carry over to the cage. But what I'm doing outside of that fight camp is giving her the foundations to be able to get the most out of that fight camp once she signs that contract. And then my training is a lot more specific. All right, cool. You're fighting this girl. This is the game plan. That means we need to focus on more power-based work. all right, let's focus on a little bit more speed in certain areas. Let's focus on working your anaerobic system so that you can be more explosive for longer periods of time for the duration of the entire fight, whilst complementing the other training that she's doing with those coaches. As we get closer and closer to the fight, you know, I start pulling back the intensity of the work that I'm doing with her. We start bumping up the intensity of the work that she's doing with other coaches. We're also managing weight. We're also making sure that she's getting enough steps in, active recovery and things like that, so that we are creating an energy deficit, managing her body weight without taking away from her ability to perform in the training sessions and her ability to recover.
When you're doing like all those sort of things, like I think from starting to do this podcast, I've got the opportunity to talk to some real high level athletes, and I've been talking to like a few rugby players from back home Northern Ireland who are playing for Ulster, who are, you know, trying to get to that national standard where they want to be playing for Ireland. And one of the interesting things that they were talking about is they were going through like their weight progression, and from going from the academy to professional rugby playing at that high level, you know, coaches were trying to maybe get them to put on extra weight, you know, to have more force when they're running. So the fella I was talking to, he was playing in hooker, and he was talking about he put on like a few extra kg, and for him he just felt too lethargic. And he says that his whole process was sort of just finding, you know, what his fighting weight was at, you know, trying to find out what his body sort of felt best at. And you know, he was talking about he felt better being a wee bit lighter because he felt that he'd get around the field more, being at more breakdowns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's an interesting concept, man. It's something that I speak about all the time, is like understanding, as you said, you know, your fight weight, what you perform best at. It's an interesting thing, because with team sports, you know, most if I'm part of a team and, you know, you get three new dudes rock up the training, you can pretty much take a look at them and go, all right, this dude's going to be, you know, a prop or a hooker. That guy's going to be a flanker or number eight. That dude's going to be an outside back. You can tell typically where someone's going to be playing just by their body shape and their height and their weight and their, you know, their body composition. And then obviously you have a look at the skills, and then you go, all right, let's tweak where this person's going to go. Maybe they're a little bit more suited to open side flanker rather than number eight, or maybe they're a little bit more suited to playing hooker or whatever. So, you know, it's a great point that you make there about coaches pushing their own agenda on players because they're trying to fit someone into a box. You know, and I think it's a hard thing to do because you want the best for the players, but you also know, like, I don't know that strength and conditioning coach, the guy that was like, hey, you need to put on some weight. You know, maybe that guy playing hooker, maybe he's, you know, maybe he's 92 kilos and the other hookers at the professional level are 105 kilos. You know, maybe the coach is like, hey, for you to compete, you need to be at least this much, right? But then that dude's like busting his ass. Maybe he's short. Maybe he doesn't have the frame to be able to put on that much bulk. So then that dude's busting his ass trying to get to that weight so that he can compete with the other guys that are going to be, you know, fighting for spots at national level. But then that's taking away from his ability to get around the paddock. That's taking away from his ability to perform for longer periods of and more sustained periods of time over the entire duration of the match. Maybe that's now taking away from his power and his speed. Yes, he's going to be a little bit bigger. He's going to be a little bit stronger, but then that's going to affect other areas of his game as well. And, you know, it's again, man, like people are trying to put people into a certain box and get them to fit the criteria that people are looking for. And I mean, sometimes that comes down from the international level or the national level. Like maybe the coach at the national level is going, this is what I want. I want my players to be around about this size and fit this category so that they are a part of the team, right? So there's so many things that go into play here.
There was like, I was talking to a guy, his name is Michael Lowry. So he broke into the Ulster setup when he was quite young. So the way it sort of works over here is, you play school, and the Ulster professional setup, it's split up into two teams. You've got Ulster Club in Ulster schools. So Ulster Club is for all the people who don't go to a rugby school. Basically, they play at a club level, which is on a Saturday. So you've got those two sort of brackets. But Michael, he broke into one of the schools over here, doing really, really well. He was a small fella. I think he's about five. I think he's 5'6" currently. So he plays fullback, really, really good feet. And the whole way through school, what coaches were telling him is, well, you're not big enough. You're not strong enough. And, you know, he used that. Like, he talks about it openly. He used that as fuel for himself. He says, well, do you know what? I'll be better at the things that I need to be better at. So for him, being a fullback, being able to read the play, being able to watch for the high ball, when catching the ball, to make yards after contact. And he was going through this whole progression. And he was talking about, like, he was talking very simple terms. And he said, you know, he broke into the Ulster team. He just got into the Pro 14 team of the season. So he's had an absolutely fantastic season playing for Ulster. Yeah. And he's 22 at the minute. And he says, well, if you really think about it, say I put on an extra 5 kg, is it really going to make that much of a difference? Because I'm probably going to be running the a centre who's probably 90 kg. Is that 5 kg really going to make a difference? For me, it's better that I'm more explosive, that I'm faster, that I can hit those gaps.
Yeah, exactly, man. You know, that's everything's sacrificed, right? Like, if, as you said before, like, you know, that extra 5 kilos, if how heavy did you say he was?
I think he's 70.
Yeah. And man, like, you know, yes, he is going to need to put on a little bit of size to be a little bit more competitive, but, you know, that's going to be at the expense of something else. Hopefully he's got a good coach that's going to be able to go, hey, let's put on some size, but let's also work in some strength, speed, power, blah, blah, blah. Like, let's complement all of your great attributes rather than, you know, taking away from them by adding too much strength to, or too much weight too fast. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I think the thing that sort of stuck out most to me, and obviously you're from a rugby background, you know, if you're playing off 10 or playing off an out half and you're very, very small, you know, you're not going to be taking crash balls straight down the middle. You're going to be a wee bit smarter with it. You know, you let someone a lot bigger, like an 8 or a big 12, take those crash balls to make the hard yards. You know, you'll be focusing on the wings and going for that sort of play. And, you know, that was one of the points that he made. You know, like, how realistic at a professional level are you going to make someone take a crash ball who's that height, you know, right up the middle in their prop? You know, there's not much sense in it.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, again, it goes back to what I was saying before about the coaches. You know, those national level coaches, they understand what sort of game they want to play. They understand what sort of style they want to play. And they know what style, they know what their game plan is going to be for, you know, those different teams that they're going to be playing. So they want to, you know, sometimes they want to have a bigger inside center that is going to take those crash balls. Sometimes they might have a smaller inside center that, you know, can take those crash balls, but also has good hands to be able to, you know, run decoys, but also get the ball wide and get the fullback to slot in. So, you know, there's so many different areas that need to be considered with this. And it's, I mean, that's what I love about team sports, man. It's like trying to figure out the best way to put the best blokes on the field that are going to complement each other.
Yeah, it's one of those things with rugby, especially. You know, rugby is one of those sports where anybody really can play. You know, it's like all sizes are welcome. You know, like if you're talking about soccer, football, whatever you want to call it, you're looking for probably someone who's a lot leaner and a lot faster. While rugby, there's room for bigger players, stronger players. You know, there's so many different roles inside that 15.
Yeah, for sure, man. I mean, you look at someone like Cheslin Kolbe in the 2019 World Cup, like playing for South Africa. Mate, he dominated, man. Like, he's not a big dude, but his fucking feet are incredible. He's like my size, man. He's like 172, 171 centimeters, 5'7", 7.5, 80 kilos, man. And he was like one of the best players in the tournament and like carved up the All Blacks, one of the best teams in the professional era, if not the best team in the professional era, you know? So his game complemented the blokes around him and vice versa. You know, if you've got a dude that's that talented, you want to make sure that he's getting the ball that means that you're going to have guys that are going to be able to, you know, hit the man on the chest when he's in space, create space for him.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever watched them. There was an English fella, he was called Armitage. I don't think he played for the national team. But basically what happened was a French team came in for him and offered him a whole lot of money. And I think there's still sort of something around, you know, English players tend to stay in England, you know, to play for the national team. I don't really think they pick outside of that.
Mm.
But he went over to France and he was playing, I think he plays seven. I think he's playing, he's one of the flankers. But he's not like, he's big, like, but he's 5'11", but he's more wide than anything, a lot of weight. And one thing that he was incredible at was jackling the ball, you know, at the breakdown, just getting over the top of it and stealing it. And he was so strong. Mm-hmm. You know, it's such a brave thing, you know, to go down, jackle the ball, because you really are expecting a hit to be cleared out there. You know, it takes a lot of bravery to go over like that, especially at the professional game where the hits are massive and they're getting bigger.
Yeah, for sure, man. And that's because, you know, if you look at before rugby became a professional sport, you know, the players were working full-time, part-time jobs, you know, so they weren't spending all this time in the gym, bulking up, you know, having nutritionists that were, you know, putting them on meal plans to bulk up and gain strength and blah, 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 blah. So, you know, the size of the players has increased dramatically. I think I heard a stat or saw a stat recently. I'm not sure if it was rugby league or rugby union, but it was something along the lines of like the props of today, on average, have put on like 10 kilos over the last 10 years. Like a kilo a year is the average like playing weight, man, for the last 10 years, a kilo a year. It's crazy. 10 years ago, props were 10 kilos lighter on average.
It's even when you look at the scrums, like on TV, when they're doing like when this international team's playing, the way the scrums, and they'll say, well, this scrum weighs over like 1,000 kg.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
And they're talking about that. But that's, I think probably the best example that you could give is that if you look at like back in the day, you had Jonah Lomu, who was 6'3", really dominant wing.
Mm.
But now there is a lot of 6'3", 6'4" wings.
Yeah. Yeah, he kind of paved the way. He kind of paved the way for those bigger guys to push out to the outside back, big, strong dudes that could run, man, could catch and run, you know. So typically before him, most wingers and outside backs were smaller. Like, oh, this dude's small and fast. Like, put him out on the wing there, give him some space. But then, you know, someone like Jonah Lomu comes along and just fucking like runs over the top of people. Yeah, I think that definitely opened the floodgates for, you know, some of those bigger, faster, stronger guys to start pushing out into the outside backs.
I'll tell you that story. So I remember I was like playing under-20s rugby, and we were playing in like some cup competition, and we were playing against a team who didn't have like an under-20s team. So they dropped down like just the way it is. They dropped down like a lot of firsts, seconds, thirds players that, you know, were the right age, and I think they were paying at the time for a fella from New Zealand to come over and play for them. And his name was Noel Wakatara. And he was playing prop, absolutely gigantic. I think he was 6'4", really, really heavy. I'd say he was probably pushing about 18, 19 stone.
Mm.
Massive fella, but he was so quick for a prop. He was absolutely flying. And he was just steamrolling people, you know, just handing people off, bouncing them. Absolute monster. And he was like 19 at the time.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. What happened to him?
I've no idea. He was just playing over at Dungannon. So he was playing in the All-Ireland League. So it works, what way it works for us is like All-Ireland's like sort of like semi-professional, but it's like one jump before you play for the province, which would be Ulster. But most people are already in the system before that, you know, so that there'll be more skilled players here, 18, 19, 20, who being already on the Ulster setup, and that's the players they'll develop. You know, if you're one into the All-Ireland League, you really probably have to be one of the best players, if not the best player in that league, to even get into the professional setup.
Yep. Yeah.
But you find over here, a lot of the players, when they're coming back from injury and stuff playing for Ulster, they'll maybe drop down a level and play a few games at All-Ireland just to get their fitness back.
Mm-hmm.
But that's like a semi-professional level. Like, so I think like at the most that like you'd be training like 2-3 days a week, I imagine.
Yep.
So it'll be a wee bit different.
Yeah.
What about yourself when you were playing rugby back home? How do you find the standard that is shift when you move over to Thailand? Because I've seen on your Instagram that you've played a few games over there.
Yeah, man, like I'm 35, I'm about to turn 36 soon, so you know, I'm not chasing a contract or anything like
yeah,
that.
I'm playing
because I enjoy playing, and it's a good outlet to, you know, channel my natural aggression and competitiveness and get around the boys and, you know, be a part of a team again. So yeah, man, I play now to enjoy it. I play for the fun. But yeah, I don't get to play, which I'm not upset about, to be honest. But I'm not playing like a full year competition like I normally would in Australia. You know, there's some games that come up every now and again. I think maybe a couple of weeks ago, 4 or 5 weeks ago, I played my first game of 15s in Thailand, and I've been here almost 4 years. But I've played for numerous teams around Southeast Asia, multiple tournaments, sevens and tens tournaments. Played in rugby league nines tournament as well. So yeah, I enjoy still getting to put the boots on, but I also like, you know, not having that full season to commit to, where yeah. We're training a couple times a week and then we're also playing games every weekend. So, you know, now I can kind of pick and choose what I'm available for, and I might play a couple of competitions over the course of a year. Obviously, over the last year, it hasn't been the case. In saying that, I have still played in a couple of sevens tournaments. We won I live in Phuket, Thailand, for those listening. I played in an expat team that won the Southern Province competition. And then our team went to the national sevens tournament in Bangkok and played against the other provinces, Navy, police, and army as well. So yeah, that was cool, man. Played in multiple tens tournaments and stuff around Southeast Asia, Bangkok, Pattaya, over in Vietnam a couple times. So yeah, it's cool, man. I enjoy still getting to put the boots on, but not having that full season commitment.
Just moving away from rugby, because I could honestly talk to you about rugby all day. Like, that's something I love. But moving away from that slightly, is obviously you said that you served in the army. You know, what sort of shaped your decision to go to the army? Was there something before? Was that always like in your head growing up that that's what you wanted to do? Or was it sort of like a, you know, what sort of decision was that?
Yeah. So I left home when I was 14. Got out into the workforce, left my family, left school, left the state that I grew up in. And I was just kind of forging my own path. And I always looked at anyone in uniform as like a noble job of giving service to others. So I always looked at police officers, you know, firefighters, military, paramedics, first responders, you know, with a lot of respect. And I was just kind of floating, man. Being out of home for a couple of years, came from a poor family, had an abusive stepdad, and I was just kind of out in the workforce. So yeah, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and that came up for me. It was like, I want to serve my country. I want to, you know, wear the uniform. And I just kind of started looking at different jobs, different roles. I ended up getting a rugby scholarship. So I was living in Darwin at the time, and I'd never played rugby union before. And I was working at the rugby union actually, and just started chatting to a dude, and he ended up being one of the coaches there. And he goes, "Hey mate, bring your boots down tomorrow." I was like, "I don't have any boots." So he goes, "Bring whatever you've got." So I took my runners down, had a game, played well, made some mates there. And he was like, "Hey, we've got a national tournament coming up in 6 months' time. I'm selecting the Northern Territory team. So, you know, come on down training," and blah, blah, blah. And just kind of went from there, man, and had a couple of years up in Darwin playing rugby there, and made a number of teams, like state level teams, was selected for combined states, which was like we had a tier two tournament, schoolboys tournament, Northern Territory, Western Australia, South Australia, Victoria, Tasmania. And they picked the best 23 players from there. And I got selected in that team. And I'd only been playing Union for maybe a year or year and a half or so. And then went down to Sydney and played against the tier one states, being New South Wales, Queensland, and ACT. And then I got picked up by a scout there and then went down to Sydney, had a scholarship and played a couple of years of Colts there, starting off in fifth grade, working my way up to fourth grade, third grade, second grade. And then the last 2 years, towards the end of that year, played a couple of games of first grade and then stayed in first grade Colts for the next 2 years. And then I got offered a contract, a minor contract to stay in Sydney and play down there in the Shoot Shield. And, you know, I was realistic, man. And I'd gone down that path and really enjoyed it. But then, you know, obviously taking that opportunity to take on that scholarship meant that I wasn't following that dream of putting on the uniform to serve my country. So I ended up walking away from that minor contract and moving back to Darwin and applying for the army and then getting in, being accepted and going away to recruit training in 2006. And then 2007 went to Iraq, 2008, 2009 was in East Timor. And 2010, 2011 was in Afghanistan and then discharged from the army in 2012 after we were told that we were no longer deploying. So I was like, well, I'm not, you know, going to go out bush. I'm not going to sacrifice, you know, relationships and basically my life if I'm just going to be out bush training and I'm not actually going to get to go overseas and, you know, put that training to the test and do my job for real.
I think the one thing, I think I followed your Instagram a few weeks ago, and the one thing I can say about your Instagram is with some of your posts, you're incredibly honest about the life experiences that you've had and the lessons that you've learned, And I think for people listening back home, that I think they should definitely give you a follow, because yes, you post a lot of inspirational stuff and things that'll make you want to get up and do things, but you also post like a lot of really good advice.
Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate it. Keeping it real, bro.
Yeah. What I want to talk, I seen one of your posts and it was talking about doing your basic sniper training and how that was one of the hardest, if not the hardest experience that you had. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah. So I did Iraq 2007, East Timor 8-9. And I was in what was called recon snipers platoon. It was some of the best soldiers in the battalion. And I got nominated to do the snipers course by my junior leadership. So I undertook that course. It was 2 months and it was fucking brutal, man. We were set up to fail. Like the first couple of weeks of the course, nobody was winning anything. Everything was fail. And they made it so difficult that, you know, and you got to think, man, like these are the best soldiers in the battalion that have been nominated by their hierarchy to, you know, potentially become snipers and deploy to Afghanistan. So, you know, it was harsh, man. It was difficult to keep our heads up because, you know, some of the best soldiers in the battalion are failing time and time and time again. And the instructors deliberately made it that difficult to test us to see how we were going to perform. We didn't know it at the time, but, you know, we just thought, fuck, man, nobody's going to be able to pass this course. This is so stupid hard. But, you know, as we went through the course, things started to click. We started picking things up. We started putting things together. And the cool thing was, as I said, the instructors deliberately made it so hard that it was designed for us to fail because they wanted to see what we're made of. They wanted to see how we're going to perform knowing that we'd failed this task the last six times in a row, and we've got that same task coming up again, slightly different scenario, slightly different circumstances, but same task. You know, how we're going to perform knowing that the chips are stacked against us. And you know, that type of mindset, man, like I really appreciate it looking back now. It really taught me how to build resilience, both mental and physical resilience, but not only how to build that, but also how to condition yourself to it and not attach emotions to, you know, winning or losing. I mean, it's all well and good to win something. And fuck, man, I've won seven rugby premierships, right? Like some of the best times of my life. you know, but that emotion wears off. That elation wears off. And it's the same thing going the other way. If you lose the rugby grand final, right, like that disappointment also wears off. But some people might carry that their entire life. And they play this what if things, you know, scenarios in their head. There's no power in that, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what that sniper course taught me was the ability to manage my emotions and stay level-headed and condition myself to resilience and not attach, you know, these emotional reactions to whatever was happening, whether we're winning or losing. You know, obviously if you win something, sweet, be emotional, enjoy the moment, right? But don't hold on to that and constantly try and do that again and again and again, because then you're just going to set yourself up for disappointment. Mm-hmm. You know, likewise, when you are losing things, when life's not going your way, you know, yeah, be sad, get emotional, be upset, be frustrated, right? But don't let that fucking continue on for extended periods of time, because that's where issues start coming into play.
I think one of the things that's sort of been the theme of the podcast, I think, I haven't released the episodes yet, but for like the last three episodes, is facing adversity. And the sort of conclusion when you talk to all these people, no matter what walk of life they're in, whether it's professional sports or whatever, it's always that adversity eventually makes you stronger. Yes, the times are very, very bad. They're sore. They're not nice. It's awful to be in. But when you actually look back at it, there's almost like a fondness there, because you look back at that time and you can sort of see that it's molded you into almost a better person.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, man. That's a message that I'm constantly sprouting on my social media platforms and on my own podcast as well. But I listened to a podcast recently. I can't remember who the guest was or what podcast it was, because I listened to so many. But they were talking about the difference between post-traumatic stress and post-traumatic growth. You know, and people think that stress is a bad thing. Stress is necessary for adaptation. If you're not doing something that's going to stress you out and challenge you, you're never going to fucking grow, right? But there's a dose response relationship. If you're doing something that is causing too much stress, then yeah, that's going to fuck you up, right? But if you're doing something that's going to just put you slightly out of your comfort zone and you condition yourself to that, and then that becomes a new norm, then you challenge that again. You create a little bit more adversity. You adapt to that, and that becomes a norm. And you continue repeating that process, right? So an example of this is, you know, I'll use a really simple example. If you're trying to build a little bit of mental resilience, have a fucking cold shower first thing in the morning. I'm not saying you need to stand there for 5 minutes in freezing cold or in an ice bath or something, right? You might just have a hot shower. And then the last 10 seconds, boom, cold, just 10 seconds, right? That's just enough that you're like, hey, you know what? I can do this. It's only 10 seconds. It's going to fucking suck, but I'm going to be able to do it. All right, cool. You've just won. You've just created a win. You've just challenged yourself and you've walked away winning that battle. And then you repeat that process the next day and then the next day and the next day. You do that for a week or two. Sweet. Now you've accumulated whatever, 2 minutes of cold therapy first thing in the morning, which is going to have this massive physiological response within the body and also give you that mental resilience, that mental toughness, that first achievement for the day, right? Once you can do that, then go, all right, now I'm going to do 15 seconds or 20 seconds, right? And I keep building, I keep adding on that. But if I said to you, hey, jump in the ice bath 5 minutes first thing in the morning, and you've never done it before, that dose is now too large. And you're going to probably get out after a minute and be like, oh, fuck that. I can't do that. That's way too hard. So you're not going to do it again. Right. So that's what I mean about that dose response relationship. Choosing the right dosage to give you the right response without overdoing it, so that you can create that win, you can create that achievement, which then flows on to the next thing.
think it's, I was talking to John about this, and he was talking about just as far as actual goals go, like what's your goal? And he would write down his goal for, say, the year. And then he's able to sort of visualize that, work towards that, whatever. And then he looks back in the year and sees that he's made that goal. But I think a real positive thing is that when you have a big goal, for example, for me, I want this podcast to grow. So say it's 1,000 followers or 1,000 subscribers, 1,000 listeners, whatever it is. It's setting smaller goals beneath that, almost like milestones. Like, so almost just each meeting the milestone. For anything in life, you know, if you want to lose weight, you want to get fitter, yes, have that goal, but also have goals in place, like individual milestones to actually meet that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%, man. You know, working with, obviously I'm a strength and conditioning coach, but the earlier parts of my career, working as a personal trainer, I'm working with, you know, general population clients. And for the most part, the people that are paying for personal trainers, 90% of them want to lose weight, right? So most people, you know, I'll give you an example of how I go through goal setting with them is if they come to me and they go, hey, I want to lose 10 kilos. Why? Blah, blah, blah. All right. What are you willing to do to achieve this? X, Y, Z. What's your level of commitment? How committed are you to achieving these goals on a scale of 1 to 10? I'm a 10. All right, cool. Are you willing to track your food? No, now you're a 9. Are you willing to get 8 hours of sleep? No, now you're an 8. Are you willing to, you know, take 10,000 steps a day? No, now you're a 7. Are you willing to, you know, train for minimum 30 minutes 3 times a week? No, now blah, 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 blah. Just go through that process, right? And, you know, you get a gauge on where people really are, because people want the results, but they don't want to do the work. But if someone does want to do the work, all right, cool, let's break that down. You want to lose 10 kilos? All right, where are you at right now? How many calories are you eating? I don't know, I've never tracked that before. All right, cool. I want you to do that first, because that's going to determine where we need to go next. If you've been dieting for extended periods of time, your body's created metabolic adaptation, your metabolism slowed down because it is evolutionary physiological response, then we're not going to cut your calories. Maybe we need to go through a reverse diet. Maybe we need to, you know, get you healthy first for the next 2, 3, 4 months, get you doing some solid weight training to, you know, shore up your joints, focus on structural integrity, get your body moving properly again, you know, before we go through a weight loss phase. Right. So then I'm like, cool. Now we're at the start line. Now you want to lose 10 kilos. All right. That means that, you know, we need to create an energy deficit. We can do that by blah, 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 blah. All right. This is the training that we're going to do to support that goal. And I'm looking at losing whatever, 0.5 kilo a week for the first 8 weeks. And then we're going to go through a reverse diet again for maybe a month. And then we're going to do this, blah, 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 blah. So I'm like laying out a plan for them and managing the expectations. But, you know, as you said, it's about looking at the end goal. That's where I want to be. That's what most people look at, man. And that's all well and good, right? But where the fuck are you right now?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody looks at that, right? This is the issue. It's like, if you don't know where you're at right now, then how do you know what direction you need to be moving? Because, you know, if you just, any road will lead you there if you don't know where you're going, but you don't know where you are, right? So people need to know where they're at right now, get their baseline, and then go, that's where I want to be over there. How am I going to close that gap, right? Strength and conditioning. I'm working with someone like, I spoke about it earlier, man, that periodization.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got my client who's signed a fight contract for 8 weeks' time. All right, cool. I've already built the foundations over the last 6 months. Now I'm looking at 2 weeks out from the fight, I need you at this weight. We're working backwards. Your weight needs to be here on this date. You're flying on this date. I want you at this weight before you fly. That means that 4 weeks out, we need to be here. 8 weeks out, we need to be here. 12 weeks out, we need to be here. Okay, how do I fill in those gaps? What tools am I going to use to tick off those checkpoints as we approach our goal? I go into this is a topic I could talk all day about, man. But if anyone's listening, that I apologize for plugging my own podcast. But if anyone's listening, they want to know more about this stuff. I've spent like entire episodes going through goal setting, the power of habit, creating consistency, the effect of your environment, hierarchy of value, motivation, direction, blah 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 blah. Like meal preparation, restricting temptation, basic health markers, objective tracking, subjective tracking, blah blah blah. All this shit in my own podcast, Live, Train, Perform. So if anyone's interested in learning more about that stuff, then yeah, go and listen to that. So I don't go too far off topic.
Well, you work away, because I think what I'm starting, which this is something that I love. Like, so I started this podcast. The reason why I started it was I wanted to talk to interesting people. You know, I'd listen to like all the podcasts, all the big podcasts that you can imagine, like the Joe Rogan Experience, The Fighter and the Kid, whatever it is, listen to all these podcasts, and they're all talking to like really interesting people, and they're telling their life stories. And I was like, well, why can't I talk to these people for myself and find out, you know, what I want to know?
Yeah.
And that's the reason why I started this. And then I started talking to more interesting people. And I think the more, I'm a firm believer that, you know, like, every person I've had on is very, very successful and they do things well. And when you start listening to that, it sort of starts to change how you think as well.
Yeah.
And change your mindset. I think it's all very, very good, you know, listening to these sort of things.
Yeah, for sure, man. And I mean, that's one of the reasons why I started my podcast as well, is, you know, one, I want to help people cut through the bullshit, because, you know, there's so much in my industry, mate, in the fitness industry, there's so many fucking snake oil salesmen, and it pisses me off, you know. But I'm also realistic, and I look at economics, right? Like, if there's a demand for shit, then people are going to supply it and charge you a premium for it.
Yeah.
So if people are looking for the fucking magic pill, and some douchebag comes online and is like, whatever, fucking six pack abs in 6 weeks, like, people that are looking for that shit are always going to find it, you know, because people are going to supply it. Whereas I take that kind of longevity approach of, you know, yeah, could I get someone a six pack abs in 6 weeks? Well, yes, but it depends on so many factors, right? But can that person keep that after they go through that 6 week program? Probably fucking not. And this is where most people go wrong, is they look for that short term result. But that short-term process, there's no lessons in that, man. Anyone can fucking restrict themselves with food and get after training for, you know, 6 weeks and really be disciplined for 6 weeks and hammer themselves for 6 weeks, right? But what happens when they come out the other side? They haven't learned anything. All they've learned is restriction and crazy discipline and crazy training and stupid dieting. Right. So they come out the other side, they go back to eating normal, they go back to living life normally, and they put all that weight back on plus more. And they go, oh, I know what got me into shape last time. I'll do this stupid fucking diet and this crazy training program for 6 weeks, and I'll get back in shape. And then same thing happens. They come out the other side, they haven't learned those lessons. That's where the lessons are, man, in the fucking journey.
Yeah.
You know, you don't just get to, you don't go from point A to point Z without picking up those lessons, you know. And this is the big point. This is the big reason I started my podcast, was to give people these lessons, man. I've been training for 20 years. I've done everything wrong. I trained like a fucking bodybuilder for 10 years. I was like in Afghanistan working as a sniper, carrying 35 kilos of equipment. I was like 78 kilos, 79 kilos at the time. I'm carrying 35 kilos every single patrol I'm going out on, every foot patrol, with my body armor, my helmet, my weapon system, ammunition, water, food, you know, spotting scopes, binoculars, radio equipment, spare batteries, blah, 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 blah. I'm carrying an extra 35 kilos, man. I'm training like a bodybuilder. I'm hammering my fucking legs at the gym, and then I'm stepping out on 8-hour patrol and I can't walk properly. Well, I'm a fucking idiot, aren't I? You know, I did that for 10 years, man. And then I figured out, hey, there's a better way to do this. And you know, that's why I love strength and conditioning, because it's taking you know, different modalities and understanding that, you know, different training modalities are going to give you different responses and elicit different results, right? People take, you know, a strength training protocol and they turn it into endurance. People take a power training protocol and turn it into endurance. People take, you know, this is CrossFit, man. You know, you take excellent exercises like a power clean. I'm using a power clean. Okay, let's look at the tools. Why am I using this tool? All right, if I want to, if I said to you, hey, man, I need you to take the wheel off this car, what tool are you going to use?
Mm-hmm.
Probably going to choose a wheel brace, right? If I said to you, oh, I need you to fucking smash this nail into this tree, what tool are you going to use? You can choose a hammer, right? If I say, hey, I want you to cut that tree down, probably going to choose a chainsaw, right? Now, it's the same thing with training. Same thing with everything in life, man. Everything has a reason to be using it. Choose the right tool for the appropriate time, right? CrossFit is like, let's take this Olympic lift and let's do it for reps. Let's do it for time. Let's do it for fatigue. Let's combine that with these box jumps. Let's combine that with these sprint-based movement. Let's combine that with, you know, reps on the or calories on the rowing machine, blah, blah, blah. You're taking all these excellent tools and you're combining them, and now you're taking great tools for power, for speed, for endurance, for aerobic conditioning, for anaerobic conditioning. You're putting them into one session. Now you've just taken all these individual tools, excellent tools in their own right. Now you've mashed them all together and turned them into shit tools to elicit a different response than what they're good for. So going back to the analogy I was using before, if you need to hammer in a fucking nail into the tree, you're going to choose a hammer, right? But can you hammer that nail in with a spanner? Yes, you can. Can you use a fucking screwdriver? Yes, you can. You know, can you use your phone? Yes, you can, but probably not going to be ideal. The best tool for that job is going to be the hammer.
I think it's also important as well that, you know, having someone like yourself explaining all that sort of stuff when it comes to strength and conditioning, individual wellness, your mental health, talking about all these sort of things, you know, it's about you giving people the information as well to know what tools to use. Because like for myself as well, like when I first started going to the gym when I was 15, 16, whenever it was, like I didn't have a clue, like just completely winging it. And then it was also like when you first sort of start, you know, that embarrassment, like, am I doing it right? And it's a very childish way to think, but am I doing this right? Or are people looking at me? And it's all those sort of individual things that you have to look at. But it's always good when you have someone in your corner who knows what they're doing and to be able to give you the tools to use.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point, man. Yeah, this is the benefit of having a good coach, right? Mm-hmm. But I mean, at the end of the day, like that, again, that's why I started my podcast, because I get random people messaging me all the time on social media asking me these vague as fuck questions. And I'm like, hey, I like don't know anything about you. I don't know anything about your training background, your injury history, medications you're taking, you know, your training age, your experience, training modalities, blah, blah. I don't know anything about you, what diet you're eating, how many calories you're eating, macronutrients, micronutrient deficiencies, blah, 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 blah. And yet I'm being asked these like black and white questions. And I'm like, I can't give you a black and white answer. Yeah. So, you know, hey, what's the best diet to be following? Well, that depends on so many things. Now I can go, hey, go and listen to my 7-part mini series on the nutritional pyramid of importance. Where the first episode, we go through the introduction. Hey, nutritional pyramid of importance, on, you know, the base of the pyramid, we're looking at energy balance. Are you getting enough energy in to support the training that you're doing to also allow you to recover and manage your stress without putting your body under unnecessary stress and load? Then we go into macronutrients. What are macronutrients? Why are they important? You know, what do they do for the body? What happens when you have deficiencies? Then the next base, or the next component of the pyramid is micronutrients. All right. These micronutrients are important for these physiological processes within the body. If you have any deficiencies, this is what you're likely going to see. Maybe you have some problem with your hair, your skin, your nails. Maybe your skin's going to be dry, your nails are going to be cracking, or your energy levels are going to be a little bit low. You're going to have crashes throughout the day. You know, you might have psoriasis, or you might have acne, blah, 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 blah. All right, what's the next thing? Now we go through diet. Let's look at the different diets. Let's look at diet culture. Let's look at the history of dieting. Let's look at who's making money from these different fucking diets. And then let's figure out which diet is going to work best for you. We look at calorie cycling. We look at carb cycling. We look at different diets. We look at, you know, adjusting macronutrients to suit what you've just done, what you're just about to do. Then we go into supplements. All right, cool. There's 3.5 hours of general information regarding nutrition to help you set up your own nutrition protocols, mm-hmm. right? Go and listen to that stuff. Then ask me your questions. Right. Then I can make it a lot more specific. And that's why I started the podcast, because now I've got my online coaching program where, you know, my clients listen to my podcast or you know, I had a couple of client calls before I jumped on this call. And all my clients like, yeah, listen to this episode. Hey, I've got this coming up. What are your thoughts on this? Boom. I've already done an episode on that. I can send them that link. Then they listen to that 30-minute, 40-minute episode or whatever. Then they send me a message. All right, cool. When you spoke about this, what does that mean? How can I apply that to my life? Now they've got that general information. Now I can make it a lot more specific to their individual circumstances. You know, and the same thing goes for everything on the podcast. Like I said, man, I start off with 2 weeks of information around accountability, goal setting, mm-hmm. Progress tracking, you know, checking basic health markers. How many people know what their waking heart rate is? How many people know what their waking blood pressure is? How many people actually knows what heart rate variability is, right? This is basically how much stress your body's under. And if you wake up and your body's under stress because you've had a couple of nights of poor sleep, your nutrition's been off, you drank too much alcohol, you know, your sleep patterns have been a little bit off, you've got some financial stress, or, you know, you're having issues at work, then your body's under stress. Going and hammering yourself at training is now not a good option, right? Now you need to manage that stress and drive the parasympathetic nervous system, not the sympathetic. So now you should be choosing different things that's going to allow you to relax, that's going to drive that recovery response, you know, to allow you to get back to homeostasis, which is baseline, because people live in this perpetual state of sympathetic upregulation, which is our stress state.
You know, what... listening to you talking, and obviously you've got a whole lot of information on your podcast and stuff, and you're going through a lot. See, when you were on this sort of journey in health and fitness, did this start just playing rugby and then going to the army, and then did you develop more after you left that, or has this just been an ongoing sort of journey, or is it more of like a recent thing after you left the army that's what you started to pursue?
Yeah, no, good question, man. It's been an ongoing thing. You know, obviously, the tools that I've used have changed over the years, along with knowledge and experience and, you know, understanding the body a little bit better, understanding that I can't just smash myself. Because look, man, you know, as I said, I left home when I was 14. I started training when I was like 15, because I was that guy. I was that kid that was like, you know, 63, 64, 65 kilos playing rugby against fucking adults and just being small and fast with good footwork. But then if someone got hold of me, I was fucking being ragdolled, right? So I started training because I was like, hey, I need to put on some size. I need to get stronger so that I can deal with, you know, playing rugby against adults much better. You know, so when I first started training, it was all about, well, pretty much my entire training life has been about performance. I'm looking to, you know, and yeah, aesthetics is one thing. And yeah, I was training for a little bit of aesthetics, and I have done that at times. It has been my focus, but it's never really been the main priority. The main priority for me in regards to training has been around performance, right? So what does that mean? That means that what I'm doing at the gym on the training paddock should be carrying over and complementing my life. And my philosophy hasn't always been this. It's something that's developed over time. you know, when I was younger, I was just like, I need to get into the gym more. If I want to get bigger, I need to get into the gym more. I need to eat more. But what I didn't realize was I was a super active kid and I was busting my ass at the gym, burning through a fuckload of energy, as well as working a physical job and, you know, taking 15,000 steps a day. And I'm still like in an energy deficit. For me to build muscle, I need to eat a whole lot more. So it's not just the training. Now I started looking at nutrition. Then I joined the army. And then I was like, again, like I'm in Afghanistan carrying 35 kilos on at baseline. If I go out on a 5-day patrol, now add another 50 kilos on top of that, man, with, you know, 5 days worth of water and food and sleeping gear and spare batteries and ammunition, weapon systems, blah, 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 blah. Thermal injury, imagery, night vision. You know, I'm carrying another 50 kilos on top of that. Now I'm like 78 kilo dude carrying fucking 80 kilos, 85 kilos of equipment. If I've just hammered my legs, now I'm a fucking idiot. Now I can't do my job, right? So,
yeah,
you know, that's then taking away from my performance. My training is then taking away from my performance and limiting my ability to do my job, which then makes me a liability, which could potentially get someone killed, right? So I very soon realized that I need to change my training, and my training should be complementing my life, not taking away from it. And again, like over the years, it's just developed, man. It's been these little things that I picked up through different training modalities, different periods of my life, different jobs, working with different people. And, you know, obviously the more experienced I became, the more knowledgeable I became, you know, the more I realized how everything was interrelated, right? So when I was in the army, again, I was just, the focus was just on hammering myself. But then I got to a point where I was like, well, if I do too much, now that's taking away from my ability to perform. All right, how can I improve my performance? Then I start looking at sleep. Then I start looking at nutrition. Then I start looking at, you know, gut health, stress management, mindfulness, blah, 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 blah. All of these things that are going to complement me and give me the data, again, that waking heart rate, blood pressure, heart rate variability, give me the data to tell me how much stress my body's under. So then I can tweak my day and know that, hey, I can push a little bit harder today because my body's well rested. I'm in a parasympathetic state. I can get after it today and drive that stress. Again, stress is important. Yeah, I can add stress to my body now, knowing that my body is fairly well managed in terms of stress. So now I can add stress through training today. It's going to rest, recover, and adapt above and beyond baseline, right? But then if my stress level's high because I haven't slept well, I trained too hard yesterday, I didn't eat enough, you know, I'm a little bit deficient in some micronutrients. Now, if my body's stressed, I know that I can't get after my training today because now I'm taking away from my life rather than complementing it. So now I'm going to choose different training modalities. Maybe I'll do some mobility. Maybe I'll do some stretching. Maybe I go and get a massage, focus on recovery. I might do some mindfulness or meditation or, you know, something that's going to allow my body to recover so that I can get after my training again tomorrow.
We're sort of jumping back and forth here, and I'm going to change the topic slightly. And it was just something when you were talking there that sort of stuck out to me. So you were talking about being in the army, and you were talking about doing things that, you know, that wouldn't put your team in danger if you train too much, putting your team in danger. I'm sure at certain stages when you return, like touring and going wherever it was, Afghanistan, etc., did you not find like about your mental health and stuff? Like how did you sort of not have that stress and that pressure on you? You know, obviously some stress is good, but you know, it's a real big burden to have someone else's safety is like, you know, your main concern, if you get me.
Yeah, man. So again, I've spoken about this numerous times on my podcast and on social media, but I'll give you like a very quick snapshot of what I mean about like stress management. So 2 weeks into my trip to Afghanistan, I was part of a 4-man sniper team. My team leader was shot and, you know, we patched him up. Well, we got into a firefight, did what was necessary to eliminate the threats, dragged him into cover, patched him up, put him on a helicopter, sent him off, didn't know if he was going to live or die. Then the rest of my sniper team, there's three of us left, went up onto some high ground so that we could, provide precision fire and battlefield commentary and communications to the rest of the team that were following up the dudes that we'd been in the firefight with. And we'd been up there for about 30 minutes on this high ground, had a little bit of cover there. And one of the boys like flicked aside some dirt and looked at us with big wide eyes and was like, fuck, boys, we're sitting on top of an IED, an improvised explosive device that luckily didn't go off for whatever reason. So, you know, almost fucking died twice in that day. Got back to patrol base, slept for a couple of hours just because the adrenaline dump was so massive. Again, they get that stress, that dose response relationship that I spoke about earlier. Everything's tying in, man. You know, that dose of cortisol and adrenaline was so fucking high, and I'd gone so hard into a sympathetic state that my body had to balance it out. And I didn't know this stuff at the time. Looking back, I understand it, but my body had to swing back into a parasympathetic state and go, all right, cool. Like, you need to rest, you need to recover, you need to, you know, get back to baseline, which means that, you know, we need to shut down these systems so that we can start, you know, reducing inflammation and start regulating pH balance and hormones and blah, 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 all these other things so that you can perform again. So anyway, that night went in to the command post, found out we're going back out on patrol the next day. Still hadn't heard what had happened to my team leader. Went out on patrol the next day, burst machine gun fire, like ripped up the ground between my mate and I. And I was like, fuck, this is going to be a long trip. So the next couple of weeks, I was, you know, struggling to get to sleep, man. I was playing these what if scenarios in my mind. We'd go into the command post every day, get our plan for what we're doing the next day on patrol. And, you know, we know that we're going into this area. We know it's fucking dodgy. We know there's bad dudes there. We know every time we go there, we're getting in firefights and where, you know, we're losing guys through injury, you know, losing legs and, you know, had some casualties. A couple of dudes died as well. So every time we go there, we know that it's fucking bad. So I hadn't been taught anything from the military on how to like manage the mind. It was always just like front up, throw your boots on, fucking soldier on. So I hadn't been taught these tools. So what I had to do was every night I just went to bed and I was like, right, I need to get to sleep, man, because I'm waking up and I'm fucking tired, which is affecting my ability to perform and do my job and, you know, be on high alert to any threats. I was the lead scout of my sniper team. So it was my role to choose an appropriate route that was going to mitigate the risks of being ambushed or stepping on an IED or, you know, missing something and having the bloke behind me, you know, lose his leg or be killed or be shot in the chest or whatever. And that was always something that was playing on my mind. So, you know, not sleeping was affecting my ability to do my job. So I just simply started counting my breaths and just focused on that, man. Every time my mind would wander, I'd come back to just counting my breaths. And it wasn't until, and you know, after a couple of weeks, it allowed me to get to sleep and allowed me to get restful sleep so that I was waking up the next day going, all right, cool. I feel good. I feel like I can perform now. I feel like I can do my job to the best of my ability. And it was interesting because, you know, the reason I started doing it, because I was like, I need to sleep. But the unintended consequences of focusing on my breath was that I was actually changing my mindset. And instead of going, hey, we're going to this area tomorrow, what if this, what if that, blah, blah, blah. Instead of that, it was like, okay, if this happens, not what if this happens, I'm going to do this. If that happens, I'm going to do that. And I was giving myself peace of mind and mitigating those risks before they even came up. I was going through my standard operating procedures. I was going through my actions on. I was, again, giving myself that peace of mind so that I could rest, I could relax, knowing that if the shit hit the fan, I knew what I was going to do, you know, and it changed my mindset from being on the back foot and being reactive to being on the front foot and being proactive, you know, so that's something that I've implemented into my life ever since, man. It's funny because last year, around about just before, it was probably like February, actually, just over a year ago, I was back in Australia. I did my yoga course. I'm a yoga instructor. But the reason I did my yoga course was one of my mates got out of the army after Afghanistan as well. And he suffered from PTSD. and he used yin style yoga as alternate therapy for PTSD instead of taking medications and things like that. So, and it really helped him. So he ended up becoming a yoga teacher and has helped numerous like veterans and first responders manage their mind and deal with anxiety, depression, and PTSD. So he got a partial grant from the Australian government and ended up teaching a bunch of veterans this modality of yoga so that we could take it back to our own networks and help our boys manage their minds, right? And when I was on that course, I told that story about being in Afghanistan. My mate, Rosie, who I've had on my podcast, was like, dude, you've been meditating for years. You just didn't know it. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. You know, so most people look at fucking meditation, man, as woo-woo shit, right? Now, where's that information come from? Like, yeah, you've probably got these yogis and these like hippies that are like, yeah, man, do some fucking meditation, blah, blah, blah. Like, no one's going to listen to that shit unless you're into that, mm-hmm. right? But if you've, here's the thing, man, there's high-level operators, you know, a lot of sports teams are using sports psychology, and they're doing this mindfulness stuff. You've got these high-level operators, SAS, SBS, Commandos, you know, Green Berets, fucking SEAL Team 6, all these different SEAL teams, Navy SEALs, blah, 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 using these mindfulness techniques because they need these tools, again, going back to those tools, to be able to manage their mind. Because if they're, you know, if they're always in that warrior mindset where everything is go, 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 they're always eliciting a stress response.
Yeah.
Right. And if they can't switch that off and they're constantly in this stressful state, that affects their ability to get to sleep. That affects their ability to be able to perform. They end up burning their endocrine, their hormonal system out because they're constantly releasing, producing cortisol and adrenaline. And those things are good when they're good. But when they're happening all the time, they're no longer good. It now becomes a chronic issue, right? So this mindfulness, meditation-based stuff allows those warriors to switch off that inner chat, down-regulate that sympathetic nervous system, drive the parasympathetic nervous system, which is essentially, hey, turn that warrior mindset on, drive the sympathetic state. Turn that warrior mindset off, drive the parasympathetic nervous system, right? So it's about balancing that out, using these tools to be able to, you know when the right time is to switch on and know when the right time is to switch off.
It's one of those things, like, I think everybody can relate to that. And obviously you were going through a really stressful situation, and you know, not everyone's going to feel stress. No matter who you are, you're always going to feel stress at a certain point in your life, and it could be a daily thing. And you know, mindfulness is something that's very good. You know, like if you're going outside and you're feeling particularly stressed, you know, it's just focusing on picking one or eight and focusing on it, and focusing on like the here's and now, like the grass is green, and you know, just sort of going through that instead of focusing on what's actually stressing you out. I think probably the biggest thing with anxiety is what people tend to do is when they're in an anxious frame of mind and there's a lot of anxiety going on and a lot of anxious thoughts, the automatic response is you want to argue with it.
Yeah.
And you want to almost have that sort of debate within yourself of what's actually going on, the what if moments, and you're going through this what if situation that hasn't happened, and there's all these different responses and your mind's going wild. And sometimes it's very, very hard to make it go quiet, but something that I found in my own life is that when you're going through an anxious period and you're going through that anxious situation, sometimes it's okay just to acknowledge that thoughts came into your head, but just let it go out one ear and out the other, just like acknowledging it. You know, you don't need to argue against it. Sometimes
that's a great point. That's a great point, man. Like most people think that mindfulness meditation is quietening the mind. Most people think that, oh, well, I'm not good at this, so I'm not going to do it because I can't quieten the mind. I've constantly got things coming into my head. Like, that's not the point, man. The point is to, it's always going to happen. You're always going to have these thoughts come into your head. The whole point, the whole goal of meditation mindfulness is to go, all right, these thoughts are coming into my head. I'm going to let them come. Then I'm going to let them go. I'm not going to attach any emotions to them. I'm not going to attach any meaning to them. You know, maybe afterwards I'll do a little reflection and go, oh, okay, wonder why that thought came into my head. Maybe it's associated with this. Maybe it's associated with that. Am I going to pay attention to it? Nope. That's, if I pay too much attention to that, that's going to stress me out. That's going to create anxiety. You know, is it important for me to pay attention to that? Nope. All right, let it go. Is it important to pay attention to that? Yes, it is important to pay attention to that because that affects my quality of life every single day. All right, cool. Why has that thought come up? How can I change, one, that thought, or how can I change the tools that I'm using to elicit a different response? You know, so the goal of the mindfulness stuff is not to quieten the mind. It's to, as you said, acknowledge, let those thoughts come into your mind and then let them pass without attaching any meaning or emotion to them.
It's changing. It's changing the way you think. I remember I was listening to like a psychologist talk, and you know, when you're going through an anxious state or you're going through periods and you're having all these thoughts or you're having things of what if moments, like it could be you and your partner's arguing, or it could be you're having a job and you're going through all these what if moments and what's going to happen, that, you know, the more that you engage with those thoughts in a negative way, the more you're creating like almost like a path where your mind can keep going down that, you're creating more negative patterns.
Yep. And you create an association with that, and that narrative that you tell yourself then creates an emotional response, and that emotional response then creates a hormonal response, and that hormonal response creates a physiological response. So you're making these connections with that emotion, which then elicits this physiological response, right? So, you know, that can be a fucking self-fulfilling prophecy. You can turn these negative stories into a negative experience, and that negative experience then creates more negative emotions, negative responses, negative reactions, you know, and that the more you tell yourself that story, the more of a response you get each time that thing happens.
Yeah, it's the mind is such a strange thing. You know, you're not, it's important, almost the way you exercise your body, it's important to exercise your mind as well and make sure that, you know, you're strong mentally by practicing mindfulness. But also when stresses, anxieties come up, being able to separate yourself and pull yourself actually out of that and be able to look at it from a neutral perspective. Because as you know yourself, see, when you're going through something that's negative or something that's hard, your mind is like the most crazy place to be in. You know, there's so many what-if situations and so many things that are probably never going to happen, but you're responding out of fear.
Yeah.
And it's important just being able to take a step out of that and be looking at it from a neutral. Sometimes that's why it's always really good to talk to people as well, you know, because they can give you a different perspective because they're not in it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. They're taking an objective view, whereas most people are living through a subjective view of their own eyes. And I think this is important. Like, I'm a NLP master practitioner, neuro-linguistic programming, which is essentially like understanding how you talk to yourself, and the words that you use is going to elicit different responses. So, you know, something that I go through with my clients is, you know, creating disassociation and taking an objective view and like zooming out and looking at you right now and going, why am I having these thoughts? Blah, blah, blah. You know, you look at this thing from a subjective view. Oh, maybe I'm thinking about this because of that reason, or maybe blah, blah, blah. All right. Don't attach any meaning or emotion to that. Then zoom out and go, all right, now I'm sitting 10 meters away, looking at myself, having these thoughts. Why would I possibly be having those thoughts? Then I go, you know, 50 meters out, then 100 meters out. And then I take this like big overarching objective view. All right, let's look at the big picture now. Do those thoughts deserve to, you know, come up? Do those thoughts deserve to be acted upon? When the big picture, probably not. Or if they do need to be acted upon, how am I going to elicit the best response by applying the tools that I have?
Yeah. I think another good thing when you're going through those sort of phases, it's important as well to remember that is not reality.
Yeah.
You know, like what's going on right now is not real. You know, it's an opinion of what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah. I mean, what is reality, man?
Yeah.
Reality is something that we create, right? Like everything that we perceive, if we look around right now, that's our brain, like taking a best guess. of the information that's coming in via all of our senses, and then it's painting a picture and going, oh, this is my best guess. You know, that looks like this because from previous experiences, that's what I've associated it with. You know, so we can, the mind, as you said, man, the mind is super powerful. I had a recent conversation with one of my clients for my podcast, and, you know, something that he said was, the mind is a crazy thing. It can either fuck you or make love to you. And I was like, that's brilliant, bro. But that just depends on your mindset, right? Like, I'm not sure if you saw, I think it was like last week, I posted something on social media, on my Instagram, about, it was just a shoe. You've probably seen this, listeners have probably seen this, and they probably know the dress one where people look at the dress and they see different colors. But I posted a shoe, and the shoe was like, for me, what I saw was green and gray, whereas other people saw pink and white. And the interesting thing for me was, like, I looked at that at different stages of the day when I was in different mindsets and had different emotions, and I saw different colors. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing was, all right, why am I seeing that? How's the mind working right now? And I was like, I'm going to test something. So I stared at that picture, man. It was green and gray. I stared at that picture. I stared at that shoe. And I just kept telling myself over and over and over again, it's pink and white, pink and white, pink and white, pink and white. And it took about 40 seconds or so. And I saw the colors change from pink and white in front of my eyes. And then I was like, holy fuck. I closed my eyes for like 5 seconds, opened my eyes, still pink and white. I'm like, okay, I wonder if I can turn it back to green and gray. Did the same thing in reverse, stared at it, green and gray, green and gray, green and gray, green and gray. Right. And once I believed it, not just told myself, but once I believed it, lo and behold, that fucking shoe turned green and gray again.
I want to ask you, I would like you to give advice to the people who are listening, because obviously you've seen a lot in your life from serving, and I'm sure you've had some conversations with your friends where they've told you absolutely horrific stories from their times away, and, you know, with any traumatic experience, you know, for the people listening, like if it's a traumatic childhood or a traumatic experience, how do they actually get over that and push past that and push on that, you know, where they're not living with that frame of mind that they got from a hard childhood or a bad experience, you know, how do you get over that?
Yeah, it's a hard one, man, because again, you know, I need to understand where people are right now. I need to understand, you know, the circumstances, the stories, the narrative that's being perpetuated over and over again, that's put them in their current position before I can then give advice. But I mean, to give general advice, self-awareness, mate, you know, being self-aware and understanding that what you perceive is your reality. So if you allow, you know, those circumstances to take control of your emotions and your responses, then, you know, that's going to create this cycle. Again, it goes back to those thoughts create emotions, and emotions create physiological responses, and physiological responses create emotions. But it's this cycle, man. So understanding that is the first starting point, I believe. And then going, all right, maybe if I can change the way that I'm speaking to myself, or I can create these different associations and look at different circumstances in my childhood, or, you know, from whatever traumatic injury or whatever it might be, a certain event in your life, and reframing that and, you know, telling a different story. And it's going to be hard at times, man, because, you know, you might've been telling yourself the same fucking story for 20 years, right? So it's going to take some time for you to change that narrative. But the important thing is, one, being aware, and then two, you know, trying to change that story. Again, going, man, I can, again, it's general advice. Right, I can't give specific advice because I don't know the listener's background, history,
Of course,
current status, etc. But this is where, you know, working with a good coach, working with a good therapist is extremely important, man, because they're, again, like I said before, I keep going back to tools, bro. You know, the more tools, the more, if you speak to a professional, they're going to have way more tools than you, right? They've got a much bigger toolbox. So then they're going to be able to go, hey, let's try this tool. How's that working? Yeah, I can notice a little bit of a difference. All right, cool. Let's layer this tool on top of that. How's that feel? Oh, that makes a big difference. All right, cool. Let's tweak that. Let's refine that. Let's adjust that. Let's add this tool in. Let's pull this tool out. And you're constantly, man, this is like, you're never going to find the one thing that's going to make all the difference. Sure, some things are going to have, you know, a higher order of precedence, and they're going to, you know, create more of an impact on your quality of life. But most of the time, it's all of these tools layered upon one another, stacked upon one another, once you've built a solid foundation, to then be able to tweak, refine, adjust. You know, so again, man, I feel bad for like plugging my own podcast, but if people are interested in this stuff, like that, the first 2 weeks of my podcast, which is almost a year old now, the first 2 weeks, first 21 episodes is all about that accountability, goal setting, blah, blah, blah. And then we go through a nutritional pyramid of importance, man. And it's probably like 15 to 17 hours of content of like building the foundation. And the reason I put those episodes out at the start was because I wanted people to listen to those episodes first, right? So, you know, that's all about building that foundation, layering these tools on top of tools, on top of tools, on top of tools. So then, you know, the last, whatever, 50 episodes that I've gone through is then people understand it and people hear me speaking about the same principles over and over again. But now I'm talking to other coaches. Now I'm talking to other people that are at the top of their game. Now I'm talking to some of my clients and I'm talking about these principles. I'm like, hey, this principle that you've used, blah, blah, blah. We're going way back to fucking episode 3. How have you used that in your life? How have you tweaked that, refined that? How have you adjusted that to allow you to get the most out of that? All right, cool. What tools for you work best in conjunction with that? Boom, 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 boom. All right. So people that have been listening have been able to like build the foundation and then layer on top of that. And another thing I want to bring up as well is I'm actually an ambassador for Swiss8, which is a proactive mental health program based out of Australia. It was initially designed by veterans for veterans after the founder, one of his best mates committed suicide. And he was like, man, we need to get these fucking tools out. So we can help people deal with their mental health because, you know, as a veteran, unfortunately, we've buried way too many of our mates over the years. And, you know, it's a big problem that we're trying to work through. So basically Swiss8 started an app and they've got 8 pillars of health and wellness, which is sleep, nutrition, time management, discipline, fitness, personal growth, mindfulness, minimalism. And the app allows you to schedule in these different elements throughout the day to allow you to be better at life. And all of the content providers are veterans, you know, so, I've got a training program up on the app. My mate Tristan, who, like, as I said earlier, was the yoga teacher, has got his like mindfulness based components up on the app. I've got some other veterans that have other training programs and meal plans and, you know, all of these, different modalities under these different pillars of health and wellness. And I've put together a Swiss8 mini series as well, where I interviewed the founder of Swiss8, Adrian Sutter. Then I went through and spent like 45 to 50 minutes covering each one of those topics. Sleep, how can you optimize your sleep? Then we went through gut health. How can you optimize your gut health? How does your nutrition affect your thoughts? How does your nutrition affect your immune system? How does your nutrition affect your hormone regulation and your sleep and your ability to perform and recover? All right. Then I went through time management. How can you optimize your time so you can, you know, get the most out of every day? How can you build discipline into your life? You know, what does personal growth mean? Why is that important? You know, then went through mindfulness, minimalism, you know, and then I finished with a conversation with Tristan to wind up the other end of the Swiss 8 miniseries. You know, we talked about his anxiety and depression and PTSD and suicidal thoughts and, you know, the tools that he used, all the Swiss 8 principles that he's used to, you know, get himself out of that hole and help, you know, 10,000 other veterans and first responders deal with their own mind, man, and get back to a place where, you know, they are functioning members of society. And they've, you know, used these tools to improve their quality of life and take control of their life rather than being controlled by their circumstances, their emotions, their mindset.
I'm going to let you go here in a wee second because I know that you have to get going for your friend. But I'll ask this just because I think it links it all pretty nicely together. Did you watch the UFC, the card on the weekend?
I did, yes. It was an incredible card.
Well, the part that I want to focus on is obviously with Rose has had her own sort of like mental health battles and whatever's going on. And just in the ring, just before the fight, it's just saying, I am the best. I am the best. I am the best. And then she wins the fight in spectacular fashion. Now she's a world champion again. And, you know, that's obviously something that she's been working on is her mindset. And, you know, it's sort of like that self, is it affirmation? I'm not pronouncing it correctly. But, you know, just that inner belief.
Affirmation.
Yes, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah.
And just being able to say that and you know, she's done it.
Yeah, man. And that's brilliance from her coach, right? Because as you said, like I could tell watching her, I was like, all right, you know, she's, I don't know what her personal history is, but you know, I was like, I can tell that she's had a tough time, man, with mental health. Like she's got low self-esteem. She doesn't believe in herself, but that's the brilliance of her coach to be able to like get her to believe in herself and say these affirmations. And, you know, when Joe Rogan asked at the end, it was like, hey, you know, coach, you're saying I'm the best. Like, what does that mean? And she kind of like broke down, man, into like happy tears. And she's like, I am the best. And he goes, yes, you are. You know, it was kind of like that, that moment where she realized, you know, that she was the best and she fucking deserved that title, man. You know, so again, that goes back to those, how you speak to yourself is very important, man. It creates certain responses, physiological responses in the body. And, you know, it's so powerful, man. The mind is fucking powerful. So you can use it for good. You can use it to move you in the right direction, or you can let it sabotage you. Right. But, you know, you can influence it, how you speak to yourself, how your emotions affect you, how you react to different circumstances, you know, different situations, different people. You know, do you require internal validation or do you require external validation? Internally validated people are those people that go to bed every night and, you know, everyone goes to bed every night and they turn their light off and they crawl in bed and they're left with their own thoughts. That's it. Their internal dialogue. It doesn't matter what they do for work. Doesn't matter how many friends they have, how big their house is, how much money's in their bank, blah, 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 blah. Everyone's left with just their thoughts. Internally validated people, they go to sleep like knowing that they've done their best that day. You know, they don't care what other people think about them. They validate their own existence, their own achievements, their own values. You know, externally validated people are those that require external factors to make them feel good about themselves. And if you're externally validated and you require other people to compliment you or, you know, whatever to make you feel good about yourself, then you're always at the whim of other people. If you meet 10 people that day and you're externally validated and they're all having a shit day and they don't say something that makes you feel good about yourself, that's now fucked up your day. You now feel shit about yourself. And now you're looking for material possessions to give you that validation. You know, so I think changing that mindset from an external validation in towards an internal validation is super important, man.
What's that? Sean, I could talk to you all day and I just want to thank you for your time. I've really enjoyed hearing your story and then also just moving past that and talking about the skills that people can use to help themselves develop their own mental health and their own mental well-being as well as their physical health. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on. And shout out your podcast again and more people can find you. And then I'll also tag it when I up it on Spotify.
Beautiful. Thanks, Josh. Really appreciate it, mate. You can find me at Coach Cobes, Coach_Cobes, K-O-B-E-S on Instagram. My podcast is Live, Train, Perform, and that's available on all good podcast listening platforms. I've also got some of the podcasts, some training plans, some of these like philosophical conversations on my YouTube channel, which is at Performance Functional Training.
Super, Sean. Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you, brother. Much appreciated.